More stories of sexual harassment are emerging, including at our state capitol. Advocate Denise Rothheimer says Senator Ira Silverstein threatened to kill a bill she was working on when he found out she had a boyfriend. And she disclosed the upsetting story during testimony in the state house this week.
I lost 20 pounds. My hair fell out. I was so scared that I would have to admit myself into a hospital because I went down to like 109 pounds. I had like no control in the situation.
And the first indictment to come down in Washington linking the Trump campaign to Russia involves A. George Papadopoulos. As it turns out, he's from Illinois.
He was the coffee boy. I mean, you might have called him a foreign policy analyst, but, you know, if he was going to wear a wire, all we know now is whether he prefers a caramel macchiato over a regular American coffee.
That's former Trump campaign advisor Michael Caputo on CNN. We find out more about who Papadopoulos really is. But first, as farmers are bringing in their harvest, we'll look at this season with corn, soy, and wheat farmers. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The first domino has fallen from the federal probe into Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. Court documents released earlier this week revealed that George Papadopoulos, a former Trump foreign policy advisor, pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his ties with Russia. And as it turns out, Papadopoulos actually has deep roots here in Illinois. You've probably been hearing a lot about Papadopoulos, especially on the cable news circuit this week as the news broke.
He was the coffee boy. I mean, you might have called him a foreign policy analyst, but in fact, you know, if he was going to wear a wire, all we'd know now is whether he prefers a caramel macchiato over a regular American coffee.
That's former Trump campaign advisor Michael Caputo on CNN. Who is George Papadopoulos and what are his Chicago ties? WBEZ political reporter Dave McKinney has been looking into that this week and is here to help us answer that question. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, good morning, Nyla. How are you?
Good morning, Dave. So this big national story, Illinois connections here. What do we know about the time that Papadopoulos spent in Illinois? He was actually born in Chicago and raised right outside of Chicago, correct?
Well, yeah, he was born at Swedish Covenant Hospital here in the city in 1987. He's 30 years old now. Graduated from Niles West Township High School in Skokie. And went to school at DePaul. And, you know, it was DePaul where I guess you could say there was a bit of irony in all of this, given his role, admitted role in trying to, you know, arrange meetings with people tied to the Kremlin and zeroing in on Hillary Clinton emails. He learned his first bit about Russian foreign policy and Russian politics on the campus of DePaul University in Chicago's Lincoln Park neighborhood.
And so you've been talking to different people at DePaul about this. We've got a little bit of tape of that. But before we hear that, what have you been hearing his former professors and people at DePaul talking about him?
Well, I mean, you know, there are people on campus certainly who remember him. He was a 2009 political science major, graduated from DePaul before moving on to more education outside the country. What people here remember him for, I mean, I spoke with the professor of his who taught him Russian politics and Russian foreign policy, and he didn't recall Papadopoulos as being an outstanding student. And he related to me an encounter that he had after President Trump, as a candidate, put him on this foreign policy committee. And at that point in time, this professor in Chicago was over on an educational trip in the Ukraine and gave an interview to a Ukrainian newspaper and toward the end of that interview brought up the fact that Trump had just named his former student to this advisory panel and seemed rather amazed by it. He said, he was quoted in that article as saying that Papadopoulos was a terrible student and that he doubted whether Trump even knew who Papadopoulos really was. And so in an encounter after that story was published, Papadopoulos here in Chicago confronted this professor and said, I'm disappointed that you did this. And he basically made the case that, you know, I'm going to prove to be a knowledgeable member of the foreign policy team that the president's assembling. The irony is that he certainly has proven to be knowledgeable, at least in terms of what the federal prosecutors are looking into now. I mean, he seems to be a very important key in where they're going.
So we're speaking with Dave McKinney. He, from WBEZ, Chicago Public Media. Earlier, he spoke with that professor as he's talking about Richard Farkas. Let's just hear a little bit of what he had to say.
I don't recall him being an outstanding student in that class.
In the Russian politics or Russian foreign policy?
Either.
And then he also, just to underscore also, Dave, what you're saying, we have another bit of that interview, too. Let's hear that.
I don't know what George told them about his exposure to such people and such levels of authority, but my guess is it was a bit exaggerated.
Dave, that's Professor Richard Farkas. So he's saying, and we've seen actually the idea that George Papadopoulos' resume was a bit exaggerated, was that something that came out even during the campaign, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you have a young man at age 30 who really kind of appears out of nowhere. And, you know, the president at one point, I believe in March of 2016, when he named Papadopoulos to this committee, you know, he put out on his Twitter account a picture of Papadopoulos at a table sitting between president or the, you know, the candidate Trump and Jeff Sessions, who was heading up this foreign policy group. And there were four or five other people at the table. So it was clear that this was candidate Trump's top shelf foreign policy team that was on display. And later, during an interview with The Washington Post, Trump described Papadopoulos as an excellent guy. So, you know, this idea that he was just sort of a guy to fetch coffee for people or had no role, you know, clearly he wasn't billed that way initially by the president or later on in that interview.
And so he didn't stay in Illinois forever, right? As we're hearing about his ties, he left DePaul. You reported he got his master's degree from the University of London. That's sort of the backstory to then him becoming a research associate, then moving to join the Trump presidential campaign. I wonder, you know, as we're talking about this guy, Dave, you're a longtime political reporter. I wonder what your impression is of this, of George Papadopoulos, based on the reporting you've been doing. We've seen his professor diminishing him, President Trump diminishing him, all of his campaign advisors, sort of the whole Trump administration now saying this guy did not have a big role. I don't know if your impression, the FBI doesn't seem to be doing that. I wonder, based on your reporting, where you think the truth lies.
Well, I mean, you know, clearly the president and his team right now are in a bit of a defensive crouch over all of this. I mean, you know, they expected Paul Manafort to be indicted, I believe, and an associate. But this idea of a guilty plea being unsealed and Papadopoulos being described as a cooperating witness, you know, after being arrested in July, I think set Trump and the White House on edge. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation about the possibility of Trump or of Papadopoulos maybe wearing a wire. You know, since July, that's a lot of time when he could have come into contact with people, you know, who would have pertinent knowledge about what the campaign was trying to do or did do in relation to contacts with the Russian government. You know, it all reminds me very much of what we in Illinois here have kind of gotten accustomed to with our governors. I mean, with George Ryan and with Rod Blagojevich, you know, those cases, particularly with Blagojevich, started out kind of small and then they built and kept building and building. And that's typically the way we see federal prosecutions, big ones, occur. You start with a small person, you get them to flip, and then they talk about somebody that they know above them, and you go up the ladder. And that's what the special prosecutor Robert Mueller seems to be doing. He's got a top flight crew of prosecutors that are looking into all of this, and this was certainly a very, very big shoe to drop.
Dave, one last question for you. George Papadopoulos' legal team is based in Chicago, correct?
Correct. I mean, he's represented by a pretty prominent defense lawyer here, Thomas Breen. There has been some reporting that has Papadopoulos still living in the city here with his mother, neighbors describe him. You know, it was sort of those typical, like, oh, he seems like a nice guy kind of interviews with the neighbors. But there was a lot of surprise. I think people, especially in the DePaul campus, you know, it's like, well, you know, he was, depending on who you talk to, I mean, his former Russian professor saying he was not an outstanding student, others you know, perceived him as a bit of a rising star because he'd gotten all the way up to the Trump White House.
Sure, yeah.
You know, there's a bit of question about judgment, like why align yourself with Trump? Before Trump, he had gone to work as a volunteer in the Ben Carson presidential campaign. And then when that folded, that's when he made the move to the Trump people. And they linked up with him. But, you know, again, he seemed to be a very ambitious young man. And, you know, the word from people at DePaul who knew him at that formative college age was, you know, man, he made some wrong choices along the way. And certainly the biggest one of all is lying to the FBI. We all know that that's a federal crime. And you know, now he's really at the center of an international, you know, scandal that has shaken the White House and very well could determine the future of the Trump presidency.
Wow. Thanks for giving us some more information and background on George Papadopoulos, his Illinois ties. Dave, I couldn't help but think, great, another Illinois tie to political corruption, not corruption, but indictment. So
we're getting good at that, aren't we?
Well, unfortunately. Thanks for giving us that information about a little bit more background on George Papadopoulos. Dave McKinney is a politics reporter now with WBEZ. Thanks, Dave. It's harvest time here in Illinois. We know we're a powerhouse when it comes to corn and soybean production. Things have been looking pretty solid so far, but there is big news. Of course, there's rainy weather today throughout lots of the state. There's other rainy weather and flooding early in the season that left some farmers in the northern part of the state struggling to wrap up their harvest. In fact, the situation has grown so dire that the Illinois Farm Bureau has actually been urging Governor Bruce Rauner to enact, quote, a harvest season emergency. We're going to find out more about what that means, as well as how the harvest is going with farmers Paul Jeske and Rich Giebert. They are joining us from Grundy and Randolph counties when not in the field. Paul serves as chairman of the Illinois Corn Marketing Board, and Rich is president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Paul, Rich, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Tom, my pleasure.
You're very welcome. Good to be here.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking time. I know it's normally this is the busiest season for you guys. Paul, let's start with you. I know you farm near Muzzin in Grundy County, right? A little south of the Illinois River in central Illinois, and you've got corn and soybeans there on your family farm. It's kind of a wet day for you today, right?
Yes, we're not quite central Illinois. We're about 75 miles down Interstate 55 from Chicago.
Okay. All right.
So we'd be considered northeast Illinois.
Yes, so you're a little north. Right.
And we have corn to harvest yet. We've got, well, depends on the days how good things go, but 4, 5, 6 days of harvest yet to go. But we had rain beginning late yesterday afternoon and drizzly through the night, and we've got quite a dense fog again this morning, so things are dripping wet.
Okay, so not a great day for you to be outside, but thank you for making the time for us this morning.
Sure.
Rich, I don't know how the weather is for you. You're in Randolph County in the southwest corner of the state. You're about 50 miles south of St. Louis. How's the weather for you?
Yes, we're about 50 miles south of St. Louis in Randolph County, right up against the river. And it was raining all day yesterday. So we're out of the field, and it looks like it almost rained again this morning. The temperature is climbing, but it's not going to harvest today. Maybe tomorrow if the sun would come out and the wind would blow.
So, Rich, how would you say, are you on schedule? How is the harvest going for you?
It's pretty fair. We waited for some beans to ripen here in the river bottoms. We got flooded out this spring, the corn that we had planted, so we planted them late, and they're just getting ready to harvest. So in about 4 days, we should have things pretty much wrapped up.
Paul, how about you, and how about farmers near you?
Well, it's progressed. Harvest has progressed tremendously the last 2 weeks. We had several inches of rain about 8, 9 days ago that put us out for several days. But farmers have been pushing very hard early in the morning and late at night. In general, I would say if you go south from me, you'll see as little as 10 to 20% of the crop in the field. But from me north, I would say there's still 20, 30, some areas even 40% of the crop yet to take out.
Did you have to plant your corn later than usual?
We had to. We actually felt very good about getting in early, and we were finished planting before we had some very, very major rain events there in early May that actually it was too wet, and then it turned extremely cold. So we actually had to replant 20% of our crop where Rich is used to river bottoms where you have that risk. We don't typically have to replant our corn. So it was a germination problem because the weather was so cold. So we ended up planting 20% of our corn crop in late May, which is fairly late for us.
Wow. Have you ever had to do that before?
No. A few drown out holes, just small spots, an acre or two here and there. A couple percent of the total crop, but 20% of our total crop, yes, this is very, very unique.
Rich, as president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, I know you're talking to farmers all across the state. And from what we've been hearing, as we were just hearing, I wonder, do you think this has been a tale of sort of two harvests in the state where different parts of the state, particularly northern Illinois, have had delays, but other parts of the state, things have gone smoother?
Well, you're absolutely right, but this is a very long state, from Carroll all the way up to the Wisconsin border, north of Chicago a bit, and so there's varying differences in weather events and patterns throughout the year. We normally start our corn harvest right after Labor Day because we get started a little sooner planting in the spring. So that's the first thing that comes out for us, and then
Rich,
we work on the beans later.
Kim, let me just stop you there. We've got to take a break, but if you don't mind, we'll continue this conversation in just a minute. If you can just hold that thought for me, please.
Sure.
And we'll continue this conversation about the farm harvest here on the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about this fall's harvest with farmers Paul Jeske and Rich Giebert from Grundy and Randolph County. So we're at two different parts of the state here. Rich is also president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Rich, you were just right before the break telling us sort of how you were talking about how long the state of Illinois is and how the weather's affected farmers in different portions of the state.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, we had flooding early in the spring, and just as well as a number of weather events that Paul had in northern Illinois, more in the May time frame, and then later in the summer, and we turned off dry, and very warm there in June. And when it came to August and September, where we normally look forward to a hurricane kind of blowing up the Mississippi River Valley, and giving us a rain in late August or early September for our soybeans, that didn't happen this year. So weather events are just quite different throughout the state, and weather can change on a dime, as Paul and I both know very well.
Right. And so it seems like you all have had some problems in terms of weather. We know that's something that farmers always have to deal with. So I wanted to wonder if you could explain, Rich, the Farm Bureau, has asked Governor Rauner to enact a harvest state of emergency. Can you explain what that is?
Well, harvest emergency, and we're very thankful that the state legislature passed that with Governor Rauner's initiative earlier this year to provide an opportunity for farmers to add extra bushels to their load or pounds to carry it on state highways. And they need to get a permit for that when there are some real weather challenges in the year. And they have to get a permit from the county and the township, the road commissioners that they work with and want to travel on. this really provides an opportunity for farmers to get their crop to you know, their grain facility soon in a more timely fashion, because as Paul said, you know, we start pretty early and stay late and try and get the harvest, you know, under roof. You know, we worked with Illinois Corn, Illinois Soybeans, and Illinois Feed and Grain Association, have worked sending letters asking the governor for this to happen sooner than later, that farmers can get this done. This also will help the grain elevators that are, for the most part, full and trying to move the grain, corn or soybeans, to the river terminals or the rail terminals to get it out into the export market or down to feedlots or, you know, in the southern part of the United States.
Paul, would something like this harvest state of emergency help you or other corn farmers?
Well, everything that you can do to speed things up is a help. I mean, for us personally, we just need some dry weather. But with our proximity to our location where we haul our grain, it's on farm storage. So for the most part, we're not traveling state roads. So we're a little unique. It probably wouldn't change a lot for us, but many, many farmers, it would. Again, Rich has described that situation very well. If you can get an extra 10% load each time you go to the point of destination, your destination point, I mean, that's one load out of 10 that you don't have to make that day. So you increase your efficiency by 10%. And sometimes hours, just a matter of saving hours, makes a difference between having your crop out and having a bad rainstorm or something, and having to go back possibly even weeks later to try and harvest what will then turn out to be a weather-damaged crop.
Mm. And, Paul, you mentioned, I wanted to go back to what Rich mentioned about a surplus of grain. We've seen pictures of how grain elevators are storing mountains of grain just outside on the ground. Has that been a challenge for you, Paul?
Yes, our storage situation is getting very tight in the area here. We were harvesting soybeans about a week ago in an area where we did not have storage, so we had to haul that to commercial storage. And four of the closest grain elevators that we can store our grain at filled up with soybeans, and so we were having to travel some 28 miles to find an elevator that had room to take the beans as we finished up our soybean harvest. And corn harvest this week, with the communications we have, everything is so easy to keep in contact with everybody, and you're on their text list. And just yesterday, I got texts from three of the local elevators that they were closing off their receiving wet corn, one as early as 1:30 yesterday afternoon, one at 3 o'clock, and one was closing at 5 o'clock, who had been staying open till 7. So, yes, I mean, it's a great problem. The fact that, I mean, part of it is we had a big carryover of old grain from last year, but in our particular area, we maybe fared a little better than some other areas did. Our corn harvest has been very, very good as far as the quantity, our yields. And we're quite surprised how good the yields are. Many farmers here are looking at the best yields they've ever had, even though the conditions did not seem like it should have yielded that kind of result with the tough spring we had. And then we were also dry in August and thought that that was certainly cutting the total yield back. But it shows sometimes that nature surprises us and knows much more about what makes a crop than what we do.
Well, I was going to say something that both of you know very well. We've been speaking with a corn farmer, Paul Jeske, and with Rich Giebert as well. Rich farms corn, wheat, and soybeans in Randolph County down near St. Louis. Paul's a little further south of Chicago. I want to bring someone else into this conversation, the Illinois Farm Bureau senior economist, Mike Dougherty. Hey, Mike, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Why, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Mike, as you've been listening to Paul and Rich talking about, in particular, Paul just sharing how great, how much surplus is actually out there, how good the harvest has been. I wonder if you can sort of give us a sense for folks who are tuning in from different parts of the state who maybe aren't intimately connected to agriculture, How important, if you can give us a sense of how important this fall harvest is to Illinois' economy overall?
Well, overall, it's a big contributor to the Illinois economy. It's the number one industry in the downstate. In many of our rural counties, when you include the multiplier effect of the corn and soybeans, once they leave that farm gate and they go to the local elevator and they go to processors, some of whom are located here in the state, that multiplies the impact of that. Plus, farmers spend a large portion of what that the final sales dollars of those corn and soybeans, the farmers used those to purchase inputs. So that means he has spent a lot of money, or she has spent a lot of money on fertilizer, on seed. 85% of our acreage in the more concentrated grain growing area of Illinois, 85% of those acres out there, that farmer is renting those acres from a landlord, from a landowner, oftentimes in the community, and oftentimes borrowing money for the year for an operating loan. So you've got banks, you've got landlords benefiting. So you've got a lot of portions of the economy that are all essentially feeding off this farm enterprise business.
And so I wonder if you can break down for us in layman's terms, when Paul is talking to us about having big yields, what does that mean in an economic sense for farmers?
Well, it's important because you don't want low yields. I mean, you've already put a certain amount of money into that crop. You've put fertilizer and seed into it, and you've had field operations. So the bigger the yield, then your return is going to be better. However, there's a double-edged sword, like there always is in agriculture, in that it's such a fiercely competitive system that around the world and within the Midwest, if everybody has good weather and everybody has high yields, then we have lower prices because we have a bigger supply. That's how economics works, and that's how the free market works. So on the one hand, it's better than not having a crop because you're going to have low prices are not determined locally. They're determined globally. So if you're going to have low prices, you still want a large crop. However, it doesn't completely get you into the zone you want to be at in terms of net farm income, because once you pay off those expenses, if the prices are low, you can still end up barely breaking even or not breaking even, even though you had a very large crop.
Right. And Mike, I want to ask this question, and Rich and Paul, if you guys could chime in too about this. You know, if you're talking about farming not being profitable as it once was, this would be the fourth consecutive down year, if that was is as we're sort of looking at things, right? So I wanted to ask you about the U.S. farm economy, how you feel about it right now. Are you feeling like the system is a little broken? What's your sense, Mike?
Well, I don't think it's way too early to be calling it broken. We're used to cycles. Farmers, the ones here on this you've been talking to, they've seen low price cycles come and go in their lifetime as farmers. And so it is a low price cycle, and it's going to take a little more time for input costs to come down. We're still paying cash rent prices on that rented, those cash rented acres is still pretty high for the income, for the price levels we've got. Although we have had some break on fertilizer prices have come down, but not far enough. Seed prices are still really high. So some of this is an input cost problem. And then the other thing that will eventually hopefully bring up prices a little more is that people need to realize our corn and soybeans, predominantly the majority of corn and soybeans, go to feed livestock both in the United States and around the world. That means hogs, cattle, and chickens mostly. So as we have these low grain prices, especially low corn prices, that's a benefit to the livestock producers because they're not having to pay as much for grain around the world. And as a result, we're seeing, especially in the last few years with these low grain prices, we've seen upticks in the per capita consumption of meat around the world, and particularly in Asia. So hopefully that will continue. And with that increase in per capita meat consumption, combined with some population growth, particularly in Asia, we'll get into some higher grain prices, assuming our farmers can compete against the other growers in South America, Ukraine, and South Africa.
Yeah, Paul, Rich, I wanted to ask you guys that. Do you feel like you're able to compete effectively across the world when we're talking about, you know, Mike has brought in for us sort of the global picture of who not just the market is, but who your competitors are? Paul?
Well, that's a tough question. The business I know, Mike mentioned cycles, and we're very, very used to that. And several years ago, things were very, very good for us, and hopefully some bills got paid down or paid ahead, and machinery, I know a lot of machinery was bought to replace stuff that was somewhat marginal. And, you know, you talk about, can we be competitive? I mean, I certainly believe we can. But I would urge, one of my concerns is some of our infrastructure that has helped us to be extremely competitive in the past is continuing to deteriorate some. And so one of my concerns is not so much what happens on my farm. I believe that we're continually getting better every year with the technology and the practices that we use. But some of the advantage we have had over the places that Mike talked about.
Yeah, when you say infrastructure.
To get to market.
Sure.
I'm talking our roads, our river system, the rail system. I mean, in our particular county here with the Illinois River splitting our county, it used to be, and it still is, the largest percentage of our corn goes down that river. And the transportation cost is far lower that way than it is any other mode of transportation. But our locks and dams are deteriorating. And just recently on the Ohio River, there was a lock that had tows backed up for days and days. And that's very, very costly for those operators that are pushing those tows. And of course, that expense ultimately reflects in the price that we get for our grain.
Rich, when we think about this, Paul was talking about infrastructure costs. Mike was just sort of talking about the global picture and competition. Where are you at? You're also, of course, not just a farmer, but president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. What would you like to see to help Illinois farmers increase their profits?
Well, as Paul alluded to, is the infrastructure is probably one of the greater challenges we can have. We've noticed, as Paul mentioned, Lock 52 on the Ohio River was locked up and not able to permit barge traffic up or down at a pretty crucial time. And we have the same challenges on the Illinois or the Mississippi that give us a real challenge. And in return, when that happens, barge traffic stops, the basis level declines, and we've seen basis at a minus 75 cents per bushel when there was lock failures, particularly on the Ohio, and you can't move the product down the river. That really impedes our global competitiveness at that point in time. And our members have pushed for years. We worked with Illinois corn and soybeans, the barge freight industry, for, I'd say, 20-plus years on infrastructure improvements of our locks and dams on rivers that we can maintain our competitiveness. When you look at Argentina and Brazil, you look at China and what they're doing on the Yangtze River, they're spending billions of dollars on infrastructure improvements that they can be competitive in this world market. You know, years ago, probably when Paul and I started farming, it was not a global market per se as what we see today. It is just grown leaps and bounds because those people around the world have more disposable income to spend. And when they do that, as Mike said, they buy protein. And protein usually comes from meat or soybeans or something like that in their diets. And that's what really helps us move our product that we can easily feed a world population. You know, years ago when I started farming, we probably fed 75 people other than our families. And today we're at 156 or 158 people from what we produce here on our farm.
Wow, that's a good example of where we're at looking at agriculture throughout the state. I want to thank Paul Jeske, Rich Giebert, Mike Doherty, all of you gentlemen in the ag industry here in Illinois, giving us a sense of not just the harvest, but a little bit of picture into infrastructure in the state and what it needs to be done to support the ag industry. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You're very welcome.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stories of sexual harassment and sexual assault have snowballed over the past month through the Me Too hashtag, and we've been hearing out of every industry, whether it's in Hollywood, the restaurant industry, or in newsrooms. Allegations have also come out from four state houses in the past month: Oregon, California, Rhode Island, and here in Illinois. More than 200 women in politics signed an open letter describing a pervasive culture of sexual harassment in Springfield. Last week, we heard from some of the women behind that letter and talked with state lawmakers about what should be done about it. One measure is a bill proposed by House Speaker Mike Madigan that would require all government officials to go through sexual harassment training every year. 2 days ago, the story took another turn when an activist named Denise Rothheimer said that Democratic State Senator Ira Silverstein sexually harassed her. Her allegations include phone calls from the senator late at night, along with a threat to kill a bill she was pushing for because Senator Silverstein thought she had a boyfriend. Here's how Rothheimer said this ordeal affected her at a hearing earlier this week.
I lost 20 pounds. My hair fell out. I was so scared that I would have to admit myself into a hospital because I went down to like 109 pounds. I had like no control in the situation.
That's Denise Rothheimer, activist, testifying in the State House this week. Just a note to our audience, Senator Silverstein has not responded to our request for comment. He told the AP, "I apologize, quote, if I made her uncomfortable. There was no mind games, no power struggle. I was working on the bill. That was my job, to work the bill. She might not like how the bill was proceeding. Maybe that's the issue here." That's what he told the Associated Press. Yesterday, he stepped down from his role as Majority Caucus chair. There's lots going on here. On top of that, it turns out the office responsible for investigating these kind of complaints hasn't been filled for 4 years. To join us once again to talk about this issue is Ray Hodge. She's a Springfield editor of The Daily Line. Hi, Ray. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me back.
So we've just kind of set up and heard the story here, Denise Rothheimer testifying this week. Can we just start with that moment, with that testimony? That was, I imagine, a pretty shocking moment in the State House when she was sharing this.
You know, what we've seen is that there has been a reluctance for names to actually be named. And that really marked kind of a turning point, not only in the consideration of any legislation that might come forward, but it also marked a turning point in how legislators and colleagues, I believe, were able to, and this is purely editorializing, but it kind of marked a turning point in how they were willing to respond. I think seeing some names named had quite a bit of an impact.
So there has been names. There was very quick action in terms of Senator Silverstein. He is no longer in leadership, Ray. How did that happen?
Essentially, what Ms. Rothheimer's testimony included was not only that she had attempted to address these issues privately and personally and medically, but that she had brought her complaints to the Office of Senate President John Cullerton. She described in her testimony receiving very little support or not much follow-up. She also described the attempt to use the current paths for resolution, including contacting and filing a complaint with the Legislative Inspector General, who she testifies, then referred the complaint back to Senate President John Cullerton's office. She says that once she received no further resolution from that point, she attempted to contact her own state senator, Melinda Bush, and in an attempt to get something done here. What the president's office has responded about and what we're seeing now over the last day or so has been a quick response and assurance from both Senate President Cullerton's office as well as House Speaker Mike Madigan that a process will move forward and begin moving much more quickly to get that legislative inspector general position filled. So that definitely, that was the sort of change that we saw take place in the last 24 to 48 hours.
Right. And we saw this morning Politico reporting that Senator Karen McConaughey asked the director of the Ethics Commission after this testimony how many cases were before them. That's who takes up the complaints, right? That, and they're not all necessarily sexual harassment, any kind of ethics complaint.
Correct.
And she learned there were 27 pending cases the Ethics Commission hasn't addressed.
Yes. And she's become, she's sort of what we're seeing is a little bit of a walking back. However, what she's referring to was the testimony that was given by House Speaker Mike Madigan during the Pensions and Personnel House Committee, where Ms. Rothheimer also testified. It was Madigan's testimony that the commission itself still provided a function and that it was still somehow functional. Now, he did receive criticism and pushback by committee members that, you know, even if these power, structures towards resolution are in place, the fact that there has been more complaints mounting, of course, suggests that it's not functional. But the number that we're hearing from McConaughey comes out of Madigan's testimony that several cases have been received not only this year, but the year prior, and then prior to that, also a number of cases. The basic process is that if someone has a complaint, whether that is, as you said, a matter of professional ethics or a matter of sexual harassment, bringing that complaint form to the executive director of that the legislative ethics commission, then that ethics commission would consider the petition or complaint and decide whether or not to take anything up. Most of the time, when an ethics inspector general is in place, however, that doesn't automatically go necessarily to the legislators who are on the ethics commission. What it would normally do is it would go into the hands of the legislative inspector general, who, as we said, of course, is not there now. So those
right.
mounting complaints that we saw, that's essentially how those sort of accumulated and where that number's coming from.
But why? I guess the question is, have lawmakers answered why the Illinois Legislative Inspector General Office hasn't been staffed for 4 years? Has anyone answered that?
The exact comments from House Speaker Mike Madigan during the testimony were that it was regrettable that the position had not been filled. And when I spoke with the commissioners, they also said that they were, you know, the quest continues to find this this inspector general. However, as we know, multiple years without having that position filled suggests that perhaps either, you know, there's a problem with the search, or there's a problem with the searchers, you know, and it's of course not my place to necessarily judge which one of those it is, but the problem is that it remained unfilled. I'm being told, of course, that there was an interim appointed occasionally. However, any part-time or interim director that was appointed doesn't appear to have, you know, changed the fact that there is no full-time inspector since the retirement of Tom Holmes, who was the previous, and his last official day, I believe, was June 30th, 2014.
Ray, one of the major things coming out of this, apart from just the whole process of which seems now everyone has acknowledged is broken and a mistake and needs to be fixed in terms of that, is that there also needs to be mandatory sexual harassment training. Speaker Madigan's mm-hmm. bill would require this every year. Senate President Cullerton says that all senators are undergoing training next week. We've seen a little bit of pushback from that. I believe it was it Representative, is it Steve Ryken,
yes.
who was saying that he is not doing, he's refusing to do sexual harassment training. I wonder where we're at with a sense of lawmakers thinking, is mandatory training really the one thing or just anything will help undo what seems to be, to Senator Toy Hutchinson, who was on the program last week, describing this as a pervasive cultural problem. How important is the training in all of this?
Reich did, to his credit, he did release a clarifying statement shortly thereafter where he tried to express that his point in making a fuss about not attending such a training was intended to highlight the fact that training is not enough, that there needs to be more. And so his clarifying statement did kind of bring that up to speed and kind of elucidate why that pushback existed. However, the point that you raise about whether or not training is sufficient is a point that is being raised not only by women's advocacy groups and those who are stakeholders in this process, but also by several other legislators. What we saw in Madigan's bill and what we saw really in terms of the way that bill went through committee, we do know that his bill – provides multiple prongs here. So it's not just about legislator training. It's also about making sure that there's statutory language included in the Ethics Act, which would thereby allow some greater authority for penalizing or punitive or disciplinary measures. While that's still under the umbrella of self-policing in this case, because there are legislators who would be deciding whether or not to go after one of their own. There's also a third amendment, which Madigan says is in the works to this bill, which would allow lobbyists who are registered with the state to seek out counsel and protection and investigation from the Office of the Inspector General at the Secretary of State, so thereby removing even more or creating even more of an independent avenue for folks to find some measure of recourse in all of this. As far as training and its effectiveness, what we do know is that there are very few, and this is according to the National Conference of State Legislatures and their work, there are very few states who, in their statutory language, mandate sexual harassment training. California is one such. And in fact, in 2014, one of our neighboring states, Kentucky, did enact legislation requiring mandatory training once every 2 years.
Yeah, so it's a big question. Right, Ray, as to whether or not this training is, well, we'll just, I guess it's an open question as to how effective that is too, but lots of movement, I guess we can say either way on all of this front to address this culture in Springfield. I want to thank Ray Hodge, Springfield editor of the Daily Line, for being with us. Thanks, Ray.
And thank you, Nyla. Have a nice afternoon, everybody.
One last topic for us today. This is a big month to be on the watch out for deer on the road. Mating season is this time. It happens every time of this year in the fall. And last year, nearly 4 in 10 of all deer collisions in Illinois happened in October, November, and December, November being the most dangerous month. As we begin this month, we wanted to take a minute to talk about advice to stay safe on the roads. Last year, there were more than 14,000 vehicle accidents involving deer in the state of Illinois. Joining us right now is Paul Shelton. He's a wildlife biologist with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Hey, Paul, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I think the obvious question is, why is fall a higher risk? Where are they going during mating season? Is there lots of running across the road, and that's why there's a lot more activity and we motorists need to be especially careful?
Yes. Deer have, you know, throughout the year they establish what we would call a home range, the area that they typically inhabit. But during the fall, as does begin to come into estrus and become reproductively capable, the males begin actively searching for them and ranging over much wider areas. They also tend to become much less alert to their surroundings. And so not only are they moving a lot more, but they're very much less wary. And so you see a lot more road crossing and a lot less caution in doing it. And so they may actually run full speed across the road and just, you know, not paying any attention to what they're doing other than being focused on the reproductive season.
We just have about a minute or two left, Paul. I wonder if you could just quickly give us a tip or two for folks. I think the most important thing maybe is common sense tips. If you're about to hit a deer, what should you do?
Well, swerving is not the thing you want to do. First of all, be aware. You know, I think a lot of people don't think about deer until they actually see one. But, you know, particularly this time of year, be aware of where you've seen them in the past, because deer accidents are not random. And so in those areas where you've seen deer before, be particularly aware and be on the watch for them. Never assume that a single deer is crossing the road. Be looking for another one behind it. And don't swerve. It's much less dangerous to hit a deer than it is to hit a tree or a bridge abutment.
So it goes against instinct, right? You're basically saying if you see a deer, don't swerve to avoid it. Go straight into the deer.
Yeah, your brake, you know, being wary and being ready to brake, those are the two number one things that you should be doing. Slow down as much as possible, but don't swerve into oncoming traffic. Maintain control of your vehicle. That's critical.
Right. Okay. Well, Paul, I appreciate those tips. It's a good advice for us also just to remember, especially as people are distracted driving anyway, to be even more careful. You shouldn't have your phone out anyway, but especially this time of year, right, Paul, when we're thinking about deer on the roads. Of course, I guess I remember also, right, dawn and dusk, kind of the most common times to be careful about looking out.
Yes, deer are what we call crepuscular. They're very active in the early morning hours and in the times around sunset. And that's kind of exacerbates the situation because this time of year, lots of people are commuting back and forth to work at those peak times of their movements.
Right. So everyone needs to remember to be careful during that time. Thank you so much for those tips for us. Paul Shelton is a wildlife biologist with DNR with the state of Illinois. Paul, thank you for being with us. And that does it for us. That does it for us today. That's all the time we have. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great day.